Welcome to Minute Impossible. Your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to investigate with the movie Mission Impossible 1 minute at a time. I'm Jonathan.
I'm Chris.
I am Brad.
I changed it up, guys. I don't like it. I don't like it when I differ from my normal welcome. Also, my voice completely changes when I do this thing. It's like, welcome to Minute Impossible. Hey, how you doing? How you doing? I'm Jonathan.
How you doing, Chewbacca?
How you doing, Chris? How you doing, Brad? Brad, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm having so much fun. This is a great week and another great minute and some more fantastic Vanessa Redgrave, who looks like she's going to eat Tom Cruise up.
Oh, yeah. She's
definitely
in the back of the car, and she is happy and well lit.
He's yummy to her, it looks like.
He's yummy to a lot of people. Not me. I'm okay. But
it's pretty amazing exactly how big a deal Tom Cruise was. And I remember the girls in high school and the girls in college just all fawning over him. And you realize it's been a long time.
Since you felt love?
A long time where there was a movie where he had an actual romantic interest, and you might have a female character where there's like maybe a little bit of romantic tension, perhaps, but it's been a long time since there was a movie where he actually got the girl. And I don't know if it's just because he's now in his 50s and that feels weird, or we're no longer in a real romantic comedy era or romantic drama like Jerry Maguire or films like that, but... You know, in the last couple of Mission Impossibles, he doesn't get the girl. In fact, the last, you know, that's just no longer a factor in these movies, it seems.
Yeah, the last time he got the girl in a movie was, I'm going down through here. Well, Edge of Tomorrow kind of does. That's kind of a cheat.
It's another one, like I said, where there's definitely the tension there, and there's a, sort of an implication that he sees her at the end, and they're going to, like, yeah, perhaps have a happily ever
but
after.
Night and Day is this character. It's Ethan Hunt in a funny comedy getting the girl of Cameron Diaz. I like Night and Day. I think it's hilarious and charming.
I liked it as well.
I don't like their age difference. It's a little too far away for me, but, again, he charms the pants off people, so.
Yeah, and I think that was the last one where that was really such a big factor of it, like him getting the girl and them, like, basically literally rode off into the sunset at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be part of his thing, and I don't know, people got weirded out by Tom Cruise because of, like, his craziness and...
It's okay, this is a safe space, Brad, you can talk about it.
Well, I know you had a lot of talk about the Scientology stuff last week, and...
2 weeks ago, two weeks ago, so you're okay.
But... And I don't really feel the need to go too deeply into it, but there was a weird thing where you could see he sort of lost his heartthrob status after that, because women started thinking he was just weird. And the same thing happened for different reasons to Harrison Ford, where Harrison Ford just sort of aged out of being the heartthrob. So
that's because Harrison Ford is an old man.
He is a very old man.
And he plays an old man.
Yeah.
And he's gruff, and he... He is not catered to... I'm sure he's a lovely man to be around. I've heard he is very laid back because of maybe some medicinal things that he might, you know, put into his body. But, I mean, he's with Calista Flockhart. She's a younger woman. He definitely had some charisma. He is Han Solo. We know he has it, but he just... You know, I think Tom Cruise is now in that... Once you get to 50 and are playing a certain type of character, you go that route. Hugh Jackman's there. He's definitely going that way with Wolverine. Wolverine was more charming than he was a heartthrob in Logan. Obviously, that was how it was written, but he couldn't have played it another way because you just physically, you can't deal with that anymore.
Right, right.
So, yeah. Well, at 5 minutes in, I should at least say when this minute begins and when this minute ends. This minute begins with Kittredge asking Barnes a lot of questions and ends with Max talking about a warm blanket, and it's lovely. We were just talking about blankets off the air.
Yes, yes, yes. My mom is a avid quilter and has been for many years.
If you could see Brad on the feed right now, he's built a giant fort out of all these quilts. It's pretty impressive. Now Brad has one on his head, and he's making his sound town sound terrible. Because he's rubbing a quilt against his microphone. Brad's doing Foley work.
Yes, yes. Next it'll be like a horse comes in.
This minute begins with Kittredge having questions. This is where we learn that the CIA did train them. It's confusing in both the original series and in this movie. Confusing is not the right word. It's not explained. What is the IMF? Who does it answer to? We know it now answers to the CIA, but that feels like in this movie, a recent development. It doesn't feel like it's a branch of the CIA. But Kittredge says, we taught them to do it. When he talks about Ethan being a ghost and learning how to blend in, he says, we taught them to do it, for Christ's sake. So this is one of the first times we've learned that the head of the CIA understands the IMF is a division of the CIA. In the later movies, we see more of the CIA than I ever thought we would. In this original movie, if they had told me by the third movie we would see offices and like the HR department of Impossible
Minute
Mission Force, I'd be like, no, there's no way. Come on, they're never going to go into an office. And they do. In the third one, they have an office with like desks.
Oh,
it's so weird. It's such a weird tonal change for this movie. I like this when it's just a clandestine group of agents that move around the world righting wrongs. But now we know that the CIA did train them. So, of course, they would have offices. Ethan Hunt probably has a desk at Langley.
Yep.
It just looks so weird in the third movie because it was very different. And it's like, this looks like the sort of place where they would, like, you know, someone's going to ask Ethan to put in his money for the football pool.
Yeah. Well, he has a wife. He goes to parties. He goes to a potluck. This is normal human stuff. This Ethan in this movie would not be doing this sort of thing.
No, definitely. It's, you know, and it's fine. They had to try something different. And also, the third movie seemed like the first one where they really... Well, and here was a weird thing with this movie. And I liked Mission Impossible, but it wasn't a... In a lot of ways, it wasn't really a Mission Impossible movie, because when I think of Mission Impossible, and I watched different iterations of the TV show, the whole thing was, it's like, okay, we get a team together, and it's the Mission Impossible team, and they pull from a different group of people, and this wasn't that movie at all. It was Tom Cruise, it was a Tom Cruise action movie, and with some very, very, very subsidiary characters, and... You know, you had Ving Rhames and you the other characters, but they were really, really subsidiary. They didn't get their own great action sequences or anything like that. It was all supporting Tom Cruise. And the third one was when they finally made it feel like a little bit more of a team, as opposed to the first two, where it was really just Tom Cruise having action-y stuff and everybody else was sort of background for him.
Yeah, we've talked about it before that Mission Impossible has always been a group effort. And this movie... flies in the face of that. They do get a secondary team coming up in the next few weeks, but again, that team feels dispensable.
Yeah,
because they're built out of disavowed agents, so the stakes are lower than they were before, when it was a group of people that had obviously been together for years. Claire and Hannah and Jack and Ethan and Jim and who'd I forget?
Sarah
and Sweet Sarah. You know, these guys had all known each other for a while. That's not how this feels right now. Later on, it's going to feel okay, because at least two or three of the people in the group seem to be like on the ball. And then the later movies, second one is not going to have this. They went a completely different way. It was the Ethan Hunt show. For what it's worth, it is a good action film. It's just not the kind of action film I want from a Mission Impossible movie.
No, the second one was, it was a John Woo action movie where you had the birds flying in slow motion, a lot of motorcycle stuff, and really you could have taken the Mission Impossible off the title and, you know, just replace Tom Cruise with Jean-Claude Van Damme, or what was the actor that John Woo loved using before he came to the States?
Chow Yun-Fat.
Yeah, Chow Yun-Fat. And it would have been you wouldn't have barely needed to change any of the dialogue.
It would have been a forgettable Chow Yun-Fat movie where he just goes to Australia to stop a virus. And yeah, I agree. It was getting through that one's going to be interesting, but it's pretty. There's a lot of beautiful imagery in it. Probably written better too. This movie has a lot of flaws in its writing. We've talked about it in this Mission Impossible movie. Two just has a weaker premise, and that premise was written well. It's just not a good premise, and we just don't get involved. We don't care. I think it's the problem. We just don't care.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly it. You know what? I think what happens is movie franchises are different now, where now it's you make the first movie with the first three films planned out. And you're going to have the same producer on all three movies, so you do the first two Star Trek movies, and the third one is... First two are directed by J. Abrams, and the third one's produced by J. Abrams. You do, you know, the Marvel movies, there's this... Kevin Feige is overseeing all of them. With this, they did the first Mission Impossible, and it didn't seem like they had any idea, aside from just having like a vague, you know, Mr. Hunt, do you want, you know, offering him his next mission? But there's no real setup. There's nothing really planned out other than that. And it didn't feel like you got to the third movie where they were putting together like a world for these movies to live in. And, you know, on one hand, that's nice, where I'm thinking of the last Ghostbusters movie, where everything was world building, and it was a movie that wasn't successful enough to warrant having that world, because there's no, you know, it was no guarantee gimme that there's going to be a sequel to that, because it wasn't popular enough. Sometimes it's great to have a self-contained movie, and then if the popularity and the characters warrant it, do more. And that's where Mission Impossible was, but you did end up with such crazy tone differences because they sort of like were building each movie from scratch.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Chris, I just noticed in the second 16, that's where we finally see the waiter you were talking about earlier, the
Beardy McBeardy.
Underwater waitstaff.
Yeah.
The guy who I thought wasn't in this shot is in at second 16. He's standing behind Kittredge.
Yep.
We've got three of... How many people were on Team B?
Five. I think it was five.
Who are we missing? The guy at the top of the stairs? The waiter. The waiter at the top of the stairs?
No, that's the science guy. Waiter at the top of the stairs.
Okay, he's the science guy.
There was a white-haired gentleman who I'm assuming they're trying to play off as Dale Dye, but... I don't think it was Dale Dye in those earlier
shots.
That
was not Barnes, right?
No, I don't think so.
He was the guy who's sitting with a colored dinner lady.
Yeah.
The guy sitting with dinner lady, I thought, was pretending to be an old man.
Yeah, I can't tell.
I can't tell either. You never see his face in that shot, so all right. It's hard to count. I'm going with they didn't kill any of the B team.
No, I think you're right. I mean,
one other thing, I wondered if you guys caught this. At the beginning of this movie, you have Kittredge talking about, you know, all the things that Ethan Hunt could do and how they trained him. And basically, there was a thing with action movies in the 80s and 90s where you would have that moment where it was often the bad guys talking about how cool and how much of a tough guy the good guy is. It was really predominant in Steven Seagal movie, where it seemed like every Steven Seagal movie you would have a monologue. Well,
I think it's in his contract.
Yeah.
You know, this guy's a badass. He's trained in 15 martial arts. He can kill you with a look, you know, that kind of stuff. And he's like, yeah, you got to have that in all my movies.
Yeah. And this
Jean-Claude Van Damme had the same thing.
Oh, yeah. And this was seemed like Tom Cruise's moment where you needed like that little bit of exposition just so everyone knew exactly how impressive he was, as if he hadn't had the whole movie already to show how much of a tough guy he is.
Well, I think that started like in the early 80s or like in 86, especially with like Lethal Weapon, because it was, you know, it was in that script that, you know, he was this badass and blah, blah, blah. And then
Special Forces.
Yeah, Special Forces and all these things.
And also Insane.
Yeah. And he showed you that he was as well. But I think ever since then, after Shane Black did that script, everybody's done that since then. You know, as far as who these characters are. I mean, because you don't hear that in Die Hard, which is the nice thing. But, you know.
Yeah, there's no, if anything, he's just kind of like just a cop.
Yeah.
He's not a super cop.
Exactly.
And that's one of the appeals of that movie.
Yeah. But I think every movie since like Lethal Weapon has kind of wanted to make sure that you know how big of a badass their lead character is and how much. I mean, they even make fun of it in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where Indy's telling the bad guys how Marcus Brody can blend in and disappear and, you know, just basically do all these things, and they make this cut to and he's lost basically. I mean, you know, that's my favorite one because they're making fun of that whole trope, you know?
Yeah. So, this was a fun moment. Aside from having the talk about how cool Ethan is, and then, you know, just more reminder of how much I want Kittredge to be punched in the face.
And he's also now bringing up a point that everybody has a pain point, and that we've got to learn which one we need to press. Kittredge is already thinking about how he's going to take Ethan down on a psychological level.
Right.
But he's also got a great dolly shot towards him, too, because it starts out high on him and comes dollying towards him, and it gets lower, and then it's like a low dolly shot all of a sudden. It's an amazing camera shot. I mean,
and it's only probably about half a foot difference.
Yeah,
probably about 6 inch difference. So they put it on some sort of little ramp, and it starts high and just goes down, and then by the time it ends, it's underneath Kittredge's chin.
Yeah,
and just
it's amazing. It's either an arm or it's some sort of. It may even be a Steadicam shot, but I don't think so because it doesn't look like it.
No, it seems like an arm. Like it would be some sort of parabolic arm, as opposed to like a track. I mean, a track would take forever to set up too. It doesn't seem like that's worth this shot.
Yeah, it could be a Steadicam operator on a Delicam shot and then bringing the Steadicam down.
Well, De Palma really loves those sort of shots, and I remember what was the movie, Snake Eyes, movie he did with Nicolas Cage, and a forgettable movie, but just had this amazing...
The G.I. Joe movie, right, yeah. I love that movie.
Ah, good one. But that movie, forgettable movie, but that had like an incredible like one-er, like just following Nicolas Cage as he went into a casino, and just amazing Steadicam and... dolly work, and De Palma loves that. Well, he's a Hitchcock guy.
Yeah,
and Hitchcock, the North by Northwest comparisons to this movie. There's a lot of shots that are very close to Hitchcock. So,
and he also did that in Bonfire of the Vanities. The whole opening 10 minutes of that movie is one big dolly shot. You know, or Steadicam shot. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
great camera work. Wasted on forgettable, if you're lucky, forgettable movies. The only reason people remember Bonfire of the Vanities is not for good reasons.
No.
And also, but I think that movie, just like Tom Cruise, has aged out of being used as much. People don't really go, like, it's more our generation that looks at Bonfire of the Vanities as one of these passion projects that went awry.
Yeah.
On every level. Whereas nowadays, you wouldn't think about that movie as a... I mean, people don't even bring up Waterworld anymore.
No.
That movie's terrible. And people don't bring it up because it's just faded from the public.
There's bigger bombs now, you know?
Yeah, there's so many bigger bombs. There's so many bigger movies that have taken more money. I mean, back in the day, we used to think that Waterworld was a waste of money. Ha!
Yeah.
you don't know a waste of money.
No, not at all. Compared to the budgets nowadays, yeah.
Yeah, well, what's crazy now is movies can make $500 million worldwide and still be considered a bomb.
Yeah, look at Justice League.
Yeah, Justice League, the Amazing Spider-Man films. You don't have movies that make, like Bonfire of the Vanities, where it cost $60 million and made like $5 million. That sort of bomb doesn't happen anymore, where the marketing and the research is so good, they know, okay, this movie will make money, but now the stakes are so high, the budgets are so big, that you need to like make money worldwide, and it's like, okay.
And the metrics don't even add up sometimes for the movies that do make it.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of the redone A-Team movie.
Mm.
Love it. Think it's hilarious. Think it's funny. Think it's an interesting take. And if you look at it on Box Office Mojo, it made 4 times what it cost. It's considered a bomb.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Okay. Why? It's 4 times as much. What would have made it not a bomb? And that's just a one-off. That's in the same vein as this Mission Impossible movie. This movie could have been a total bomb. This movie wishes it made. I mean, it did actually make 4 times its thing, and it's considered a major coup for this movie.
Yeah.
Although it took years to make it took 4 whole years to make a sequel.
Yeah, but that's just because Tom Cruise was so incredibly in demand. It took a while for them to get it to happen. But yeah, they're not talking about making another A-Team.
Nope. Much to my chagrin.
Yeah.
It's my father and my favorite movie. My son likes it too, my 13-year-old, so.
It was a fun movie. It was, and it would have been nice to give Bradley Cooper an action franchise.
Oh, he has one now, but he's a CG raccoon.
Yeah, it doesn't have to work out.
Yeah, yeah. Let me rephrase, a non-raccoon-related action franchise.
Yeah, that's true.
You never thought you'd say that sentence, did you?
No, I didn't see that coming.
I wish I was in less raccoon movies. What? That's something you can say in 2017. My work seems to be predominantly in the raccoon and marsupial vein.
It's like, I'm not saying completely against like furry animals, but give me a squirrel every now and then.
Yeah, I want something with a fast metabolism and maybe something that's not nocturnal. I don't know. This is what I'm looking for. Crazy. But yeah, this minute ends with them talking in the car. It's Ethan and Max in a Mercedes. They're driving through the streets of Prague, so they've made their escape. Yay! Max or Maxine. Huh?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, well, like, we didn't... I love that they had to say that. And they said it in both the book and in the movie. Yeah, we get it. Her name's Max. Girls can be named Max.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal. Calm down, 1996.
Exactly. Nowadays, it's like, no big deal.
She could be named Jeremy at this point. It's like 2017. You're like, I don't care. Yeah. A girl named Jeremy. Yeah, great.
Whatever.
I don't care.
That's her name. But I love that this car shot, they're doing the rear projection or the front projection background, which is great for the driving scene.
By great, you mean terrible. Yes.
Exactly. That's what I mean.
After such great shots in that round room, and now they are definitely on a backlit, you know, video screen of, you know, Prague Street.
I guarantee you that's actual film that they shot.
Oh, yeah. It's film being projected behind them, and it is terrible.
Yeah.
In the next minute, a little bit more in the next minute, it looks like they're really acting like they're going down a bouncy road. It's like, boy, that's a bouncy car. And they're just sort of like, it's like, what the heck's going on? They're just like,
yeah, they're having to clench their butt cheeks to make them kind of, you know, kind of do the, I'm doing it right now. Podcasting is a visual medium. I'm moving up and down. Ticks me out of this scene, especially after they did all this practical stuff in Prague. I know it's hard to shoot in a car. I get it. And a lot of this stuff they probably shot in London later as pickups. So I totally get it. I'm just saying I wish it was more practical.
Yeah.
This one shot. Because I really enjoy every time we get to see Vanessa Redgrave for the rest of the movie. She's mostly in a set for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
When we see her again, she's also on a set. And I would rather see her out and about in the real world. She's very happy with him. She calls him a dear boy. She's definitely being coy with him. She loves Ethan.
She loves social media,
because he just saved her from having to. I'd be more mad. She's not as mad as I thought she'd be. She just got screwed by Job. She was handed a knock list, and this other guy came and ratted him out. I'd be pissed. I kind of want to take it out on this guy. But he did say that he will get the knock list for her.
Yeah,
he did. I guess she's playing the long con.
If she was anyone else, there would be a scene where she like grabs a gun from somebody and shoots somebody else. Like, you know.
Yeah, she shoots Frankenstein's monster in the shoulder.
He wouldn't budge. He'd just be like, look.
Nope, he'd just take it and pull the bullet out and hand it back to her. Why you shoot me, Max?
Bullet brings pain.
Ruin good jacket.
You're my mother, Max. No, shoot me. Yeah, this scene ends with her talking about what does she say is a warm blanket?
Anonymity.
Like anonymity?
Yeah. Oh, her anonymity. Yeah, from being Max and Maxine, because no one's ever gonna figure that out.
Yep.
No super sleuth is ever going to figure that out. So it's like a warm blanket for her, and that's where the minute ends. Good luck on finding some tech of the ep in this one. Let's see where we go. Brad, is there any tech in this ep?
There's a car.
It's a nice car.
It's a nice car. I don't even think I see a cell phone or anything. It's he's just in the back seat of a car. So, but it looks like a really comfy, well-appointed vehicle. So, that's technology.
The technology of the back seat. What year was the back seat invented? we'll find that out for next week. For tomorrow, we'll find that out for tomorrow. Until tomorrow, you can catch us on the Impossible Minute Force on Facebook and also on Twitter at Min Impossible, MIN Impossible. Until tomorrow, I'm Jonathan.
I'm Chris.
I am Brad.
This minute will self-destruct.